Hey guys, Jack here. Thanks as always for tuning in. Remember to head to our website, justhandspoker.com. There you'll find lots of other great poker content and everything else your heart could desire. And again, thank you for tuning in and enjoy this week's episode.
So we're back here with Zach Teutsch about a week and a half later. How are you doing, man?
I'm great. Thanks for having me back, Zach.
Cool. So I wrote in my notes that there's a really good analogy involving hedge funds, casino take, and why someone should never invest in hedge funds, which, you know, might be a controversial proposition to many of our listeners, but something that Zach convinced me many years ago over some conversation at his house. And now I'd like you to impart your wisdom upon our listeners.
Oh, that's my pleasure. So I think generally speaking, people get attracted to the idea of hedge funds, especially because they tend to be associated with elite investors who control large amounts of money, and I think that association tends to cause everyday investors, you know, who may be affluent but not exceptionally wealthy, to think that since that's what very wealthy people do, it's a good idea. It turns out it's often not a good idea for high net worth individuals or institutions. And then if you look at that class at the aggregate level and you adjust for fees, they tend to underperform. And I think the way to think about it is that one of the most important things in evaluating an investment is what percentage of your gains or losses gets offset by fees. So let me actually say that a different way. The people who operate investment opportunities and offer them are obviously not running charities. They need to make money, and so they take a certain amount of money from you for the privilege of you're being invested with them. And how big that amount of money is has a huge impact on the profitability of the investment. And I think the way that this comes, you know, into focus for poker players is it's a lot like the size of the rake at a poker table. You can be a winning player relative to the other players and still lose money because you were not winning when you accounted for the rake. And it's the same thing in investments. When you're comparing one investment to another, if the fees are different, you have to think about the effect that that has on performance. So the problem with hedge funds is that in the most common situation, historically, they charge a 2% annual fee plus 20% of profits, which is exceptionally higher. Just the 2% is already very high. To invest in a low fee index fund, which is one common way of investing, you can do that at 0.05%, which means about 40% or about 40 times cheaper than 2%. And you don't lose 20% of profits. So imagine that you were playing at a table, which I don't know, Zach, you're a more practiced casino poker player than I am. What would you say is a typical not particularly good or particularly bad rake?
I'd say it really just depends your vantage point. Like, you know, the United States, people complain about like the casinos where they rake $7 per pot, like $6 for the rake and $1 for the promotion. But, you know, anywhere in Europe, Australia, they would kill for that. Same with kind of the underground scene in New York. So to kind of like meet in the middle, let's say like 10% up to $10.
All right. So imagine for a second that one casino is raking 10% up to $10 and the other casino is raking 40 times that amount and 20% of your winnings, right? Like,
yeah,
it is in, you know, that doesn't make any sense, right? Because you can't rake more than 100%. So the math doesn't work. But like, imagine that one casino is raking 50 cents a pot and the other casino is raking, let's do 40 times 50 cents, which would be $20 a pot plus 20% of your winnings. If you had a choice of which table to invest at, or which table to play at, you would obviously pay at the 50% or at the 50 cent rake table.
So I wonder how the math works, like when you're talking about, you know, now forgetting the analogy to poker and casinos, but to like actual hedge funds versus, let's say, like, you know, like a Vanguard super low fee index fund, like how much better does the hedge fund have to outperform the index fund for it to be profitable, more profitable to invest in the hedge fund versus the index fund? How do we solve for that?
Yeah, the answer is by way more than they have historically.
Yes.
so let's do an example. For the 20 years of trailing returns that the S&P 500 delivered from 95 to 2015, so that's just a fairly recent 20-year period, the average return was 8.19% for the S&P 500. So if you invested with a hedge fund, you wouldn't have that tracks the S&P 500. I mention it because this is Warren Buffett's favorite index. He made a very famous bet where he bet against a hedge fund guy that when you adjusted for the fees, the S&P 500 outperformed the guy's index fund. Would outperform the guy's hedge fund. And so people often think of, and the S&P 500 is an index that covers the 500 biggest companies in the United States. So it's a good general proxy for how, you know, the U.S. Stock market's doing. It's not the best, but we can talk about that another time. But the point is the S&P 500 is the one most people are familiar with. So I'll use that as the example. So if you invested in the S&P 500 via a low fee index fund of the sort I mentioned before, you wouldn't have made 8.19% because you would have lost 0.05% or so due to fees. So instead of 8.19, you would have made 8.14%. And you might be noticing that's pretty close. So the math problem we're trying to do is figure out what the performance you would need from a hedge fund so that after subtracting 2% and then 20%, so effectively 22%, you would get a number that's more than 8.14%. So that would certainly be north of 10%, which mean and wow. And that is right because you're losing 20% of your gains. And then the most devious part of this whole thing is that even if the hedge fund loses money, they still charge you money. So if the hedge fund loses 10%, your real return is negative 12%, not negative 10%. So it is possible that one could run a hedge fund that would be a decent competitor to a low fee index fund, but it would have to be much more fee conscious. So I think this hits at a general trend, which is many investors overrate the importance of a good story and underrate the importance of good fundamentals.
I think there's
a poker analogy there too.
Yeah. I just to add a little bit to kind of, you know, you've given this spiel in several forms already, but like how, you know, if this is true, it means that basically every hedge fund has significantly underperformed the market over a long sample, correct?
I have not systematically evaluated the returns of every hedge fund.
But it's likely that the vast majority have underperformed the market over that have been around for a large sample, given this insane rake.
Yeah, that's right. So I should say one other thing plays here, which is hedge funds tend to perform somewhat differently than the market. That's the appeal. Mm-hmm. So it makes it a little bit difficult. It doesn't make it hard to compare when you're being methodical and doing rigorous long-term analysis with, you know, a large N, but it does make it confusing for the average person who's just looking at this because they tend to do better and worse in different environments. And so some people look to hedge funds to diversify their portfolio, even though they know that they will likely underperform. And that sort of brings up an interesting question, which is that like in poker, where you're mainly interested in expected value and variance, the same thing is true of investors. Like we already talked about how it's important to think about fees, but it's also important to think about both your expected returns and the sort of standard deviation. So sometimes so if you're measuring your portfolio by how much you expect it to grow in any given year and how wide the variation is there, sometimes adding something which has a lower expected value is a good idea because it substantially lowers the standard deviation. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
So I think hedge funds typically aren't a particularly good way to do that because their performance when their fees are so high, which means their fee adjusted performance is pretty modest. So, but that's exactly why U.S. investors are often prudent to include investments in fixed income, global equities, and even sometimes global fixed income, even though all those asset classes historically underperform U.S. equities. And the reason is you can have a very modest decline in your expected value, but a much higher certainty that you'll achieve it in any given market condition. And for a lot of investors, they would like to, it's, you know, it's worth losing a, dropping their expected return from 8% to 7.5% to half their volatility or whatever it happens to be.
Yeah, that makes sense.
That's, and that's the big insight in what's called modern portfolio theory, which was the idea that you have to think of the risk and returns characteristics of your portfolio as a whole. I mean, it's obviously a lot more complicated than that, and there's a ton of academic research, and it's a real breakthrough. But the idea that I think is the simple takeaway for most people is is actually putting two risky things together can make the outcome less risky. I'll give you a great analogy. Would you like a great analogy?
I would love one.
All right. So think about this from chemistry. You take hydrogen, which is incredibly sort of risky and unstable, and exceedingly flammable. If my memory serves, the Hindenburg disaster, the problem was that the hydrogen in the blimp caught on fire. It's super flammable stuff. And then take another element, oxygen, which fires can't survive without oxygen. If you starve them from oxygen, the fire just goes out. That's like if you put a lid on a pot where there's a fire, pretty soon the fire consumes the oxygen and it's done. So you take hydrogen, super flammable, oxygen, essential to fire, you put them together and you end up with water. You know, you take hydrogen, you take oxygen, you end up with H2O, water. And it has very different risk characteristics regarding fire. It puts fire out.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not quite so simple. But if you take, you know, there are some investments which do well when the U.S. economy does well. And there's some which do better when the U.S. economy doesn't do as well. And if you have both, you can be reasonably confident that if the economy is doing well, you're fine. And if the economy is not doing well, then something else is doing fine. And if you need there to always be something doing fine, you might be willing to accept some lower return investments.
So this is kind of a nice transition because there is a emerging, what some argue is a new asset class that, you know, generally does well when like USD is not doing as well. Mm-hmm. And that is cryptocurrencies or tokens. Using blockchain technology. And I think a lot of poker players, I know a lot of poker players, I think probably a lot of people listen to this podcast, definitely myself included, are very interested in this space, have maybe invested a little bit of money into some of the various cryptocurrencies out there. Mm-hmm. And kind of what are your thoughts just generally on this, you know, massive, massive kind of bubble and bull market that we have upon us right here with all the ICOs and everything?
Yeah, so that's a great question. I should say two prefaces before I get into directly responding. One is that though I used to work for a federal regulatory organization that regulates cryptocurrency, I wasn't involved in that myself, and now I'm an investment manager and financial planner. So I want to be really clear that what I'm saying now is in a personal capacity. I don't have any inside information about the regulation of this area. And if I did, I wouldn't share it. So, and then the other thing is, this isn't my primary area of expertise, but I'm happy to sort of talk about some general principles that apply here. So with cryptocurrency, I think you said something super interesting, which is, you know, how do we think about this bull bubble? And actually, that's the sort of essential question, is to figure out whether it's a bubble, because price asset bubbles tend to burst, or is there real genuine value that undergirds its, you know, its investment returns and strength, which
let me stop you for a second there.
Eye-popping.
Are those mutually exclusive? Because my understanding is that kind of during the internet tech bubble of the 90s, both were true. There was immense value being created, yet there was still a bubble on, you know, because people were speculating on every single company kind of providing this immense value. And I, from my, you know, basic, you know, non-professional understanding, I think I see a similar thing going on with cryptocurrency, where it seems very clear that real value is being created and that the status quo of, you know, fiat currency and how many things are done, might be changed by using blockchain technology, not just with currencies, but kind of with other technology. But obviously trying to beat the market and pick which companies are going to win is very, very different than just kind of the general trend.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that's right. And in fact, I would guess that there's almost always some value being created, which lets a bubble exist. So maybe the right way to think about a bubble is it's when the price increases exceed by some margin the amount of value created. So, you know, 10x of value is being created, but the prices have gone up 20x or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you're right. Typically that happens when people are starting to speculate. And I think a good analogy, you already mentioned the dot-com bust. And I think another good analogy is the housing crisis, where in fact, you know, there were a lot of mortgages that were performing. And if you bought houses, a lot of houses went up in price and people made money. But at some point, people stopped worrying about the underlying value. Like, I'm going to buy this house because I want to live in a house. And they started thinking of it as an investment. I'm going to buy this house. I'll finance it however I can. And in 6 months or a year, I'll flip it. And once there were enough people doing that, it caused real problems with pricing housing, because there was so much speculation going on. And the fees got out of control. Like, people started paying more for mortgages and they weren't thinking about closing costs and mortgage costs and all that stuff. And as long as the market was going up, it was fine. The problem came when the market went down and people started being unable to pay mortgages and they couldn't refinance them anymore based on higher housing values. So sometimes all it takes for the steam to sort of go out of the engine is a temporary decline. But I don't think that's what's going to happen in Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies, because it seems like occasionally those currencies have had fluctuations. Like, didn't Bitcoin have a pretty big drop, you know, a few months back? But it seems to have recovered just fine.
Yeah, right now Bitcoin is basically at an all-time high. Or at least it was last night. I haven't checked the price today. But
yeah, so I mean, yeah, there's a couple things that I would keep in mind. I mean, taking a step back, you know, the big difference, of course, between cryptocurrencies and the U.S. dollar or other fiat currencies is that there's no government entity backing them. So ultimately, if you have U.S. dollars, most people historically have been pretty confident that they're going to get paid. You know, they're in. So sometimes there's counterfeiting scams around the edges or something, but there's a very strong, the U.S. government has a very strong interest in their currency working, and they've got tanks and bombers and stuff, so it tends to work. Historically, cryptocurrencies seem to work reasonably well, but, you know, you don't have any tanks or bombers backing them up, and you don't necessarily know all that much about the people who are controlling them and what their interests are. So it's like, it's very hard to create a truly interest-free sort of currency.
Well, so I think I would push back a little bit in that some are kind of going to be more interest-free than others. And like, sure, coins where there's a set amount, like with Bitcoin or Ethereum, versus where the developers have the ability to create more coin, you know, and or like when the creators of the given coin own less of it. Like, I think there's definitely ways where, while still not completely interest-free, and I see your point, it's like impossible to have a truly 100% decentralized, like, democratic currency. I think that, you know, Bitcoin and some of the other cryptocurrencies out there are significantly more democratic and decentralized than any, you know, previous option.
No, I certainly think that's right. So another sort of key question to think about is one treating this as an investment, or is one treating this as a way to manage exchange rate risk? So, and I think mostly people are thinking of it as an investment, not as a way to manage. So, like, one thing that people sometimes do, rarely Americans, but often people in other parts of the world, like, is if they have some business interests in one place and some business interests in another place. So I'll give you an example. I have some clients who live in the United States and also have some financial interests in the European Union.
Okay.
And they go to the EU a lot. When the U.S. dollar, so they can manage that in a couple different ways. One is when the dollar is doing well against the EU and it's cheap to travel to the EU, they can just travel to the EU. And when the dollar is doing badly against the euro, then they don't travel. So that's sort of a dynamic change approach. If they decided, I want to go to the European Union every year, what they might want to do is keep some money in euros so that and buy their tickets, you know, and lodgings in euros rather than dollars so that the fluctuation of the dollar doesn't impact their ability to visit their family.
Yeah.
So that's a very simple, you know, way to manage exchange rate risk, which is trying to make it so that changes in the relative power of currencies doesn't necessarily impact your own incentives or ability to use those currencies, right? But so mm-hmm. That's like the obvious reason that you would hold a currency which isn't your home currency. But I don't.
Or
think
let's
that's
say you were a professional gambler. You were a professional gambler that wanted to be able to card count, you know, whenever there's a good opportunity around the world. So you always had, you know, $50,000 of the local currency.
Yep. Yeah. So that's a slightly different purpose. That's to create effectiveness. I mean, I feel like a big reason why cryptocurrency might be popular, particularly with poker players, is that it enables them to get money in and out of places without the same sort of government regulation and oversight. You know, of course, anybody who was, you know, a serious poker player a few years back, you know, remembered how much it decimated the online poker space when all of a sudden the U.S. government decided that that wasn't a legal activity and pushed financial institutions to curtail people's ability to put money into and off of, you know, PokerStars and all the other poker sites. But the thing about cryptocurrency is it has its own banking system for the most part. And the disadvantage of that is that it doesn't have a very long history, and so there's not a lot of information available that can help you discern the degree to which it's reliable. Mm-hmm. But the advantage is that it doesn't have one of the disadvantages is there's no oversight. Like if you know there's a bank in the United States, and you can know that they have a regulator and that somebody's kicking the tires and making sure that, you know, it's being managed in at least a reasonably prudent way. And there's nobody like that for cryptocurrencies. But that means that there's nobody who is telling you, you can use your cryptocurrency for this, you can't use your cryptocurrency for that. So for people who undertake activities which governments might object to, you know, there's a real benefit to having a different way to pay, which is good and it's bad, right? It's good if you're a poker player and you think that it's unreasonable for the government to constrain people's ability to play poker, but you might still have some concerns about human trafficking or other kinds of things where people have difficulty doing them within the context of, you know, normal banking systems. Like you might feel really squicky about participating in a system that helps make it easier to human traffic. Or you might be like, that's not my problem. I'm not doing human trafficking.
Yeah.
So I can totally see why there's benefits to people who want to engage in, you know, what you could charitably think of as gray market activities. So that makes sense. And it sort of makes sense that cryptocurrencies would be attracted to people for that reason. One of the things that I found a little bit surprising, honestly, is in talking to friends and family and clients and other folks like that in Silicon Valley and the Bay Area more broadly, is just seeing how much, you know, orientation there is to some of these cryptocurrencies because of their concerns about fiat currency and particularly the U.S. dollar. And those aren't concerns I particularly share, but I found it very interesting that they seem to be increasingly common among smart technology-oriented people.
Yeah, that definitely seems to be the norm in the Bay Area, at least from my understanding.
I mean, it makes sense, right? Because people in the Bay Area tend to be people who have a higher confidence in the idea that technology can solve social problems, or they,
yeah,
you know, yes. and you know, how to figure out how to make markets work to some extent is a social problem. So, you know, of course, people who are in technology are more inclined to think that's a technology solvable problem.
Cool. So, kind of last thing on cryptocurrency, I'm going to be honest with you, honest with the audience. I want to make sure I'm not an investing fish. I want to make sure I'm not throwing my money away. And I just want to kind of let you know my position in terms of what I'm investing in and why, and if you think it's reasonable for why I'm doing it. So, disclaimer, you know, I'm not a professional, and I've also never invested in individual stocks or anything before this period. My first kind of, you know, speculative, volatile investment was in Bitcoin about 2 years ago. And over the last few months, I've invested in a few type of alternative coins as well as Ethereum. And my thoughts for doing so isn't that I can necessarily say confidently that any of these companies are going to change the world or, you know, 50x, 100x my investment, obviously. But it's kind of a belief in the technology, and that from kind of just for fun reading about, you know, Bitcoin and blockchain technology and what a decentralized, you know, non-fiat currency means and why I think it's superior for like kind of all consumers, that's what's leading me to invest. So it's not so much that I feel like I can pick the winners. I'm trying to almost make my own like basically index fund of cryptocurrencies that have strong, transparent development teams. And, you know, it's really just on the belief that this technology is superior to the status quo, and several of these companies will inevitably be, you know, strong, or maybe not, maybe it'll be others, but that's kind of where I'm coming from. And I want to make sure I'm not, you know, making a big mistake, because if you told me a year ago, Zach, that I'd be investing in, you know, a speculative investment like this and unregulated, uncharted territory, I'd be like, why would I do that? I'm not a, you know, that doesn't make sense for my money that way.
No, I think those are all the right questions. So let's back up just a second. To your point about how, so I think there's a couple questions here. One is, should you be investing in these currencies at all? And there's another question, which you didn't raise, but I'll raise, which is how much? Mm-hmm. And then there's a third question, how? So if the first question is, should I be investing in these currencies at all? And I don't have an objection to that. I'm not an expert in this area, and it certainly seems like the returns have been good, and there's some reason to think that there's demand for the actual underlying product. So, you know, that's fine. Then the question
I just meant more as like less of like, do you think I should do it or not? And more of like, is the reasoning behind why I'm doing it sound? Or approaching
let me get
sound?
To that in just a second. I think the real question is not should you do it, it's how much should you do.
Got it.
And then we'll get to how in a second. But like, you know, generally speaking, you are somebody who takes a fair amount of your who has highly volatile income, right? Because
yes.
Poker players always have highly volatile income. Mm-hmm. So, you know, generally speaking, you might want less volatile investments because that can create some additional stability. But what if the volatility is harmonious, like the hydrogen, oxygen, water situation we talked about earlier? So, you know, the sort of big picture question is how those risks relate and whether they correlate or not. I think they're basically uncorrelated. I should also say, just to be clear, I'm not giving investment advice now. I'm like talking through the issues with you as a sort of an interested person who likes thinking about this stuff.
Also, for what it's worth, I definitely agree. I don't think there's a correlation between any cryptocurrency and how well I do at like a 2-5 or 5-10 game.
Yeah, I think those are yes, I agree. I think those are pretty much unrelated. So I think you need to you probably wouldn't want to keep your bankroll in cryptocurrency.
Probably not, but I know a few professional poker players that have found themselves in a situation where they have significantly more money in crypto than in their bankroll, and definitely not trying to replicate that myself.
Yeah, so I mean, one thing that I think is really worth thinking about is that among the best approaches, maybe the best approach to investment, says you should figure out, based on your risk, your comfort with volatility. Some people call that risk sensitivity, or basically how risk averse you are, but I think that introduces a really major bias. And I think it's better to say what your comfort level with volatility is, because everybody has a comfort level with volatility. Some people it's very low, some people it's very high, but that's much more neutral, right?
Very high for me.
Yeah, that for me player. Too. I mean, I'm comfortable with a fairly high rate of volatility for sure. Yeah. That's why I left the government to start a business helping people think about money in a smart way. anyway, so you take your comfort with volatility and what the timeline is that you're going to be investing over, and you use those factors to determine your optimal asset allocation, which, just to keep the math easy, let's say it's 25% or in stocks, 25% in bonds, 25% global, and 25% crypto, just for kicks, because the math will be easy.
Yeah.
If over time, if crypto doubles again within a year, you're going to be like at 34% crypto or something like that, and the other things will drop down to more like 20%, because that stuff's, and then what you should do is realize that your asset allocation is out of whack.
And then rebalance it,
which essentially means selling crypto to buy other stuff.
Yep.
So I think what can easily happen in a market that's running up is you become more and more and more exposed to the risk of that market as it does better and better. And when it does better and better, if it's creating a bubble, that right when markets tend to soar, they often attract speculation, and then eventually they tend to bust. So the right way to think about this is regression to the mean. I don't know what the true expected return of cryptocurrencies is, but it may well be that they're currently outperforming their expected return. So we would expect a regression to the mean, or maybe
as
not.
As a whole of all cryptocurrencies, I don't think anyone would argue that they're not.
That they're not currently exceeding. Right. So yeah. The idea of asset allocation, in part, is that you're betting that things that are doing worse than their average are going to regress towards their mean, which is positive, and things that are overperforming are going to regress down. And that's the whole idea of asset allocation, is by avoiding being out of whack, you decrease your overall risk exposure.
That makes sense.
Because exactly the things that have been growing the most are the things which should be regressing down. Does that make sense? Do you generally agree with that?
That makes perfect sense. I have a few questions, but continue before I jump in there.
Yeah, so I think it's completely reasonable to include cryptocurrency in somebody's asset allocation. I don't do it myself, but maybe that's because I haven't spent enough time, educating myself about the specific options. But I think it would be completely reasonable. And the thing that I would want to make sure people did was set a reasonable target. Like, it's almost certainly the case that 100% crypto is not the right asset allocation. And probably 70% is crazy. Like, if you want to have 5 or 10% of your investments in crypto, that wouldn't particularly concern me. I would want you to have enough in crypto that if you think it's going to go amazing and it goes amazing, you'll be happy, and little enough in crypto that if it busts, it won't ruin your life.
Well, that makes me feel happy, because that's basically been my very amateur asset allocation formula for myself.
Right. So, and the other thing is, I would be pretty sensitive to the idea that you're accepting a lot of volatility in a lot of places in your life, and you should, most investment managers and financial advisors don't think as much, I think, as they ought to about how risks in one's volatility in one's income relate to volatility in one's business and volatility in one's investments. Most investment managers pretty much focus on investments.
Yeah, and that's also a thing that I think a lot of people maybe listening to this that are business owners, that are professional poker players, or some combination of the two, can relate to, in that, it's I can't just say like, oh, I'm going to invest 15% of my, you know, profit or income after taxes into something. I have no idea what my income after taxes is going to be. Right. I can approximate, you know, but yeah.
I think that's right. And that actually, this isn't quite a good analogy, but I was talking to a client the other day about asset allocation. And I said, imagine that you are winning a lot at blackjack. and imagine that one scenario, every time you win, you know, you make bigger and bigger bets, right? And in another scenario, every time you win a big bet, you put half of it in your bag and you make another bet with the other half. And in scenario one, at the end of the night, you almost certainly are bust, right? Like at some point, you know, you will lose.
Oh, and like you mean if you just like put your entire bankroll on every bet for the entire night? Okay. Yeah.
It won't take very long and you'll lose. And, and in scenario two, things are great because you'll bust. And then hopefully if you're a disciplined person, you won't take the money out of your bag. You'll just be like, oh, well, that was fun. All right, I'm going home. I got a ton of money.
Assuming you ran above your expected value that night. Yeah.
Right. So that, that's, I think, one of the ways to think about asset allocation is when you're winning, are you over concentrating in that activity? Or when you're winning, are you using your winnings to subsidize your generalized program?
Yeah, that's right. I think it's, yeah, the analogy
it's,
isn't.
It's
isn't
a lot more complicated, actually. So maybe, it's,
yeah. I understand the analogy, but then my mind naturally goes to poker. And I think that while it's definitely true, generally when you're winning and in a highly volatile game, that's like when your win rate's going to be the highest.
Yeah, no, that's right. And there's a whole social element to poker that doesn't really apply in the same way to investments. Like, the investment goes the same way for everybody.
Like, yeah, that's not true for poker.
You don't, unless you have, you know, unless you're like an activist hedge fund owner or something, you don't really have, like, how you invest doesn't affect how other people invest particularly. Let me go back to one thing you said that I didn't want to completely lose the thread because I thought you made a really good point and I wanted to highlight it, which is your point that you're not in a good position to know whether it'll be, you know, Ethereum or Truebit or Metal or Bitcoin or whatever that will dominate. So it's probably a good idea to invest in a basket of currencies. And I think that's right. If you're going to be investing and you can do it in a low transaction cost kind of way, I think creating a basket makes a lot more sense than making a specific bet. Because if you have true inside information, you might have some trouble later. And if you don't have inside information, you're not going to do any better. You're not going to be able to correctly predict the outcomes probably any better than the market as a whole can. So I think your instinct is what you called it, creating an index fund, which I think is a reasonable way to do it. And probably there's actually a very good business opportunity there if it hasn't been adequately seized yet. Although I have
of like index funds now, but the issue is so many people disagree on like what should be included in these funds. So like Ripple, which is considered one of like, it's the cryptocurrency with, it's definitely top 10 market cap, but many people, myself included, don't really consider it a cryptocurrency because it's not decentralized. It's completely centralized, you know, so there's all these things, but my criteria is very simple. It's like spend, you know, 2 to 5 hours looking at their public Slack group, white paper, and Reddit. And if the dev team seems strong, smart, transparent, and the fundamental use case of the cryptocurrency is something that I think makes sense, then I put a little bit into that.
That seems reasonable. So, I mean, this actually gets back to a really interesting question, which is the way it sounds like the people who are creating the sort of so-called index funds are, you know, have some disagreement about what should be included. And that's actually precisely the reason I think that for U.S. stock market and world index funds, one business publishes the index. Like, you know, Standard & Poor's, which I think is now part of the Wall Street Journal parent company. I can't remember exactly. But the point is, Standard & Poor's publishes their list of which are the 500 biggest companies in the United States. And then anybody who wants to subscribe to that information or just like try to get it on the internet can create a fund based on only holding the companies that S&P publishes. I think they might, because of trademark stuff, you know, get like a licensing fee or something for anybody who wants to use it in their fund title. But the point is, the person who sets the index is different from the person who operates the fund. So it might be that you could eventually see the same thing. I mean, which actually makes a lot of sense, because what happens is they're both are competing markets for generating useful indexes. And, you know, you got MCSE and you've got S&P and you've got a couple of other entities that try to publish useful indexes. And then you've got a bunch of financial firms who then essentially compete on price to offer the most efficient replication of the index. And you have a doubly competitive, you have a market that's competitive at both levels, which tends to drive better consumer outcomes.
Yeah. So the crypto space is just very underdeveloped right now. And I'm sure we'll see something, you know, similar coming over the next few years.
Yeah. Well, you know, this is the usual case where if you have the choice between being the poker player and being the house, you're often better off being the house. So, you know, if you're the guy who figures out how to create useful platforms for people to invest in that space, that's probably a lot more profitable than actually investing in the space.
Oh, yeah.
but, yeah, so the point is, I think you're right to not try to choose which – you don't want to be the guy who was convinced that Friendster was better than – you know, MySpace. Or there were a couple other ones in there. But the point is, if you just had invested a quarter in Facebook and a quarter in MySpace and a quarter in another one, you know, you would have had a great outcome and that would have been fine. You don't want to, why would you bet one horse when you can bet all the horses if you think that it's a profitable game?
Okay. So I appreciate the non-professional investment advice, but the kind
I appreciate it.
But yeah, I just
you don't want it to get you don't want it to get carried away, right? The key idea here is to figure out what a reasonable portion of your total portfolio makes sense to be in this asset class, and figure out what your tolerance is. So there's actually a great white paper from Vanguard, which looks at the most efficient ways to rebalance your portfolio. And, you know, there's a whole bunch of options. You can take a look. But choose an option which either is rebalancing based on time or rebalancing based on tolerance or tolerance plus time. So, you know, one way to do it is say cryptocurrency will be 5% or 10% or whatever. And if it ever drops, you know, plus or minus 3% of the target, I'll make trades to get it clean. And otherwise, I won't make trades is one reasonable way to do it. Or 5% or 10%. You can have different
dollars. That's basically how I've been thinking of it. Just thinking now, you know, if this I'm sure isn't your bag, but for anyone probably that is starting to be a financial advisor and, you know, is interested in cryptocurrency, there's so many people right now that are kind of just mindlessly investing in crypto. And, you know, being able to say, like, I specialize in, you know, asset allocation for people with cryptocurrency as, you know, 5 to 15% of their total investment, like, there'd probably be a big need for someone like that right now.
That's a great thought. I think it's not probably for me, but I think you're right that that's a very important thing. I should just say a little bit about, would it be helpful if I said a little bit about who I particularly work with?
Yes, it would. I think our listeners would really appreciate it.
Yeah, so my firm is called Values Added Financial, and it has a few things that are distinctive about it. One is that I don't accept commissions or kickbacks from anyone, which is the dominant business strategy, and it's a bad approach because clients really need somebody to dispassionately and objectively evaluate their situation and help them choose the best investments. And they really don't want to be, they ought not want to work with somebody who gets bribed to offer different financial products. I mean, bribe is a pejorative term, but I think it gets to the point. So I don't accept commissions or kickbacks, which means I always can recommend the best product for the client, regardless of who's willing to offer what sort of kickbacks. So I think that's a really valuable and important thing. Currently, if memory serves, it's less than 10% of all financial advisors refuse all commissions and kickbacks and bribes and all that kind of stuff.
That figure feels a tad low.
You think there are more than 10% that?
No. I think it's sad that like that's the figure.
I totally agree. And part of it is because that's the historical way, because today's financial advisors have indirectly evolved from yesterday's stockbrokers. But the trend has been too slow, I think. And so one thing that I do that's different is I'm much more transparent and honest, and I've removed a lot of what I think of as pernicious ways that our incentives aren't aligned. So that's one thing. The other thing is I tend to be much more reliant on financial science and evidence and academic research than most people. Like, my view is that most people do sort of what I think of as investment theater, which is they do an entertainment display about, you know, how they are so smart about the market and their views of the market. And it turns out the research says all that is essentially bunk and it doesn't work. So people should be careful of folks like that. And then the other thing, which I think is very different, is I tend to work with clients on creating a financial life which helps them live a happy and fulfilling personal life. And sometimes the problem is they need more money. And that's a pretty straightforward problem to solve because, you know, that's what most investment theory is about. But sometimes, you know, people's problems, they don't have enough time, or they're, you know, they haven't structured their financial life in a way which reduces their stress. And so I help people think about how to build their financial life so that it actually makes them happy. And that comes in part because I'm very interested in the social science about, you know, hedonics and, generally speaking, what we've learned about human happiness and how to create it. So I'd say the things which tend to set me apart are that I'm comprehensive in nature, that I'm very well aligned with my clients' needs, that I'm evidence-based, and that I take a broader lens about how I can help people. So I tend to work with folks who are generally smart and thoughtful people, and at some point were able to do a pretty good job at managing their financial lives, but because they've been, you know, professionally or personally successful in various ways, their life is much bigger. They, you know, so they have less time, and they generally have been pretty good at saving previously, so they have more resources. And because they have less time and the stakes are bigger, they often decide, look, it's really time to choose somebody that's trustworthy and that can help me sort of make the decisions around the stuff so I don't have to worry about it as much anymore. And I love working with folks like that, and that's why I do what I do.
Cool, man. Well, thank you so much for your time today. This was a really fun conversation and, you know, one that I look forward to continue having with you. And I hope our audience appreciated the kind of heavy, you know, financial crypto talk today. It's not what we normally do. But I'd love to hear your feedback. And yeah, thanks so much, Zach. Have a great rest of your day.
Great. Well, thanks for having me on the show. Have a great day, everybody. Bye-bye.